Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody here, District. I'm the captain of this vessel.
And man, has it been one. It's been a fantastic voyage. I mean, fantastic can cover a multitude of different emotions. So from that angle, it's been a fantastic voyage. First mate, Chris Johnson.
As we do often, we've got to let our listeners know how to access the Here District, and no one better than Chris Johnson to give them that information. What's up?
Well, subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's the Bucks official YouTube channel. You can check out episodes there, or you can subscribe to Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to our episodes there. Here District.
So you know what's different about this? There's no noise. There's been so much noise, Chris. So much noise around this team, Chris. Over the last few days, so much noise, man. We are the darlings of talk radio, of the internet, of every podcast that has to deal with the NBA.
I like when the Bucks are relevant. I like when we're being talked about.
Do you?
Yeah.
You
know, it's nice. It's nice.
Why is that?
Because we have such a command and an inside vantage point of everything going on. And you realize how much people don't really understand or really realize about what's going on in Milwaukee when you listen to some of these other podcasts and some of the takes that they're coming up with. It's kind of like, I like it because I'm like, dang, I'm really in the know over here.
So it makes us even more relevant in terms of just where you come to get your information. You know, we've got.
If you choose to. Now, if you choose to, you will get, you know, you will learn a lot if you listen to us, or you can go to what's kind of trendy.
Yeah. So that's Spotify, YouTube, all those outlets that you just mentioned. This is where you're going to get the wheel. Going to get the wheel. Tap on in. So speaking of tapping in or tapping out, you know, there was a really good opportunity, Chris, for this team to tap out and say, no mas, we can't do it. We're playing against the vaunted Pistons, the top two defense in the league behind the Oklahoma City Thunder. They force turnovers. They offensive rebounded. They do all the things that the Bucks don't do.
Yeah.
Giannis goes down, 3 minutes into the game or whatever it is? He goes down with the calf strain. If ever, Chris, there was a reason to tap out, you're watching that game, in your mind, did you think tap out was going to be the way this team would go?
Well, you know, I didn't know. But the thing I did know, and I appreciated you for on the broadcast, was you talking about staying connected and you having that positive possession by possession energy. I know it didn't have nothing directly to do with on the court play, but as a listener, it kept me involved. It kept me engaged. Yeah. And then when you kept saying what you were saying and we chipping away and we cutting it. No, I'm telling you, you know how we do. Yeah. It was happening like simultaneously. Yeah. So you was on your positive vibe and, you know, we were making a run and we were coming back and we were making it respectable. Here's the thing. I felt like the single most important regular season victory for the Bucks in the last 4 or 5 years.
A long time.
I'm just saying, it was the single most important regular season victory in a long time for Milwaukee for a number of reasons. I think that to beat this type of Detroit team, this Detroit, not last year's Detroit, not blah, 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 the Detroit that's 17-4, that, you know, was 13 in a row, Cade Cunningham looking like a franchise iconic kind of dude, just got a Nike deal, Jalen Duren, all these dudes like you were talking about, the Danis Jenkins dude coming off the bench, and, you know, you guys were going on about Jaden Ivey. Like, them dudes had some dudes that they were trying to come with it. The move by Doc to lean into the 2-3. It's one thing to play the 2-3 zone a little bit and give them a taste of it, MJ, as we've talked about, but our guy leaned all the way into it. Hey, we are zoning up the whole game, bro.
We don't give a damn.
We do not care what you think. We don't care what your perception of us is. We don't care if you think we tough. It don't matter, bro. We zoning y'all and figure it out. That was genius that he did that. It was genius the way, but to the point of what I'm saying, why it's so important. This is a confidence booster for a young group like this. This also showed to whoever needed to see this, that this team can beat the number one team in the East without the services of Giannis Antetokounmpo. So for me, the importance that this win will carry for the guys mentally, emotionally, moving forward is immeasurable. Now, some have called this an anomaly. Some have said, hey, you know, Detroit had schemed and game planned for Giannis this whole time. And then when he goes out the game, it's sort of like figuring out who is who and what's what. I don't really care about none of that.
Yeah,
what I saw was heart. What I saw was determination. And what I saw was KPJ getting very active on the basketball. What I saw was the value the last two games of KPJ, of a guy that you kept talking about. Like, hey, he can create his own shot.
Yeah.
That sentence is so important for the Milwaukee Bucks, their future. This guy can get it done. Now, turnovers and corralling the energy and channeling the energy, that's part of this process as well. But MJ, I'll leave it at this. KPJ, the stuff that he did as far as the ability just to attack. We talked about it before when we talked about it months ago when I was like, yeah, I can't wait to play Detroit because I know KPJ is going to have a chip on his shoulder. He's going to have a little attitude to go at these dudes. He was the perfect guy to go at them. Very proud of the effort from the Bucks yesterday.
Yeah, and to your point, addressing a couple of things, KPJ had 7 turnovers. I think 6 were in the first half, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah. he did a better job of getting a handle. He was kind of forcing the issue, and I don't mind that. That's just who he is. You got to let him. You got to let him figure things out on the fly. As well as he is playing and shooting and creating and all these great positives that he's doing, if you're a smart coach like Doc Rivers is, you just let him figure it out. You don't even criticize. You know, you may give him a suggestion, like maybe, you know, you don't want to dribble into a crowd, blah blah blah. But you kind of let him figure things out. But to your bigger point, so during our open, myself and the great Lisa Byington, we're sitting there during the open, and I made the comment. She kind of looked at me like I was full of hyperbolic nonsense. But the comment was is that this is like a watershed game in this franchise's season, and over the last few years, one of the bigger games based on all the noise, everything that's going on.
The implications of the game, bro, the day, of the timing. It's like, holy crap, the Bucks could have easily rolled over and lost, man.
Right.
And you know what that would have did for just the mentality of
psyche,
the city?
The psyche would have been.
The city of everybody. Ooh. Everybody would have been like, oh, man.
Yeah.
It would have been a white flag. Now we got hope.
Yeah.
And whatever hope looks like, whatever we're holding on to, there is hope.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. There's a great, great illustration or the kind of AI generated that I sent to a couple of people, but it's a real deer kind of standing up, leaning over a railing, kind of looking to see who's coming, kind of looking to see what's going on. And it said, this is how Milwaukee fans are feeling right now. Just because right now, and I include myself in this, it's just so much uncertainty and noise and everything that's happening around this team. And then you couple that with the DC debacle, as I like to call it, the way this team folded against the Wizards the other night, up 5 with about 3 minutes left, up 11 in the fourth quarter at one stretch, and to just not close that deal against a team that was 2-16. And then on the next night or the next time you play, you're facing, as you mentioned, the Detroit Pistons, who had won 13 in a row at one point, who had been playing out of their minds, and just their defense is second in the league, and they're forcing turnovers, they're killing teams on the offensive glass, and the big fella Jalen Duren, one of my favorite young players in the league, is just doing his thing, footwork, worked out with Rasheed Wallace, all that good stuff. And so in terms of a reason to tap out, then Giannis goes down 3 minutes into the game. So if ever there was a reason to just throw in the towel and say no mas, this was it. But it was something about this team, Chris. And at halftime, we're down 4 points, I believe. And Bobby hadn't scored. Gary Trent Jr. hadn't scored.
Kyle Kuzma
hadn't scored.
You made the point on air, like, yo, we should be feeling good because these dudes have not been balling. You were like, I feel good. You're like, I feel good about our chances. The second day, I was like, yeah, that's a good point, MJ.
Well, you know they're going to give you something. So Bobby gives us 13 in the second half. He was 0 for 6. He wound up 5 for 13. You know, so 5 out of his next 7 shots, he was able to knock down. Yeah. Kyle, Cal hit a big, that big dunk, you know, that, you know, didn't a whole lot scoring wise, but his presence out there was a factor. Gary Trent knocked down a big three just to kind of sustain that momentum. So they all kind of chipped in their own kind of ways. But as you talked about, man, it was KPJ. And this is kind of going to lead us into one of our favorite segments where we look at some video of the game.
He's in every play.
So about that action, let's take a look at some of these plays from about that action and see the greatness of Kevin Porter Jr. Now, right there, here's the zone.
Defense. But look at him defensively.
2-3 zone. He's 6'6". Kay Cunningham is 6'6". He can contest him effectively. And then watch the vision.
Yes.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, just talking about it, but playing it again, MJ, it was just nice to play this zone and guys not having to get out of position. You know what I'm saying? Like, guys just sitting in the spot. Like, it was a match. There was a matchup aspect associated with it. And the Bucks were trying to rotate within the zone quickly, which you also love. Like, you're talking about 6'6". This is the difference between having Cole Anthony and Ryan Rollins running the point guard. 6'6", right here, sees over the top. Watch this. That's an underrated pass on a dime to A.J. Green early in transition. We know that Ryan Rollins sometimes has a tendency to dribble a little bit too much. He won't deliver that pass with that type of timing typically. But, hey, man, this is just the scratching the surface of KPJ's impact in this
game. So you throw this pass too soon. Now you put A.J. in a position where he's got the dribble or two. You disrupt his rhythm. You hit him right in stride, right in his shooting pocket. All he's got to do is left, right, stride, and up.
That's nuance.
Watch this catch.
Look, that's nuance. Watch. Yep.
Right. Not even a stride. He just caught that thing, turned, and shot. He didn't even need to stride into it. So that's just and just watching it from where I was watching it from in the game. You know, I didn't realize that A.J. would pull the trigger that quickly. I thought maybe
Kay
Cunningham had closed out enough where he felt like he didn't have a clean look. But I love the fact that he was so aggressive, Chris, A.J., and just pulling up right in the face of Kay Cunningham. Motorcade this, Kay Cunningham. All right, go ahead.
No, and the last thing on that, man, A.J. need to pull up in people's faces a lot more.
More often.
But you know what I'm saying? More often. Like, pull up on dudes. Like, take those jumpers. You don't got to be open. Don't be waiting till you open and passing up looks just because somebody got a hand up in a moderate contest. You too good of a shooter, bruh.
Yeah. And very, very, very rare instances are you going to have a really wide open shot in the NBA. These guys close out too quickly. They're too long. They're too athletic. Pool. And so, you know, this is about as open as you're going to be for AJ Green. And he knocked that thing down. So, all right, next clip. Clip number two. And that's all about that zone defense, the 2-3 zone, as you mentioned, Doc stayed with. Here we are again. It's an aggressive 2-3 zone. When you've got Ryan Rollins, Chris, and I looked at, now there's a miss by KPJ, but there's a good job by, who's at Kuz on the offensive rebound. And there's that second consecutive three-pointer, that momentum sustaining, get the crowd into it, connected, and all that good stuff. That's a great block by that defender. I don't know if it was Duran or whomever, but a couple of things. Kyle Kuzma staying with the play. That didn't happen against the Wizards the other night. Not assuming this is a layup that's going to fall. Kyle and Bobby right in there for the offensive rebound. Another opportunity. AJ, the presence of mind to get to that same spot. That same spot where he just knocked down that three-pointer of the possession before.
And for me, it's Kuz staying patient, not forcing up a shot, not saying, hey, I got Cade in the hole. Let's play the analytics on this and go ahead and get the open three. That was a big-time decision by Kuzma at that juncture of the game.
And I believe, if I remember Lisa Byington's call correctly, this is the first lead of the game.
First
time the Bucks led all game long,
but man,
possession and just the hustle from Kuz, the presence of mind of AJ to hustle into the play and get himself open, and as you mentioned, you know, he knocked down that possession before that, so he feels really confident right now. And great job by Kuz, who, you know, in times past may have tried to go a little one on one with Kay Cunningham.
100% he was trying to take that, bruh. That was a big time decision by Kuz to give that up. But also, MJ, what I saw with the Bucks' energy just in these plays that you're highlighting, the hustle plays, the way that they were playing were the results of guys that got on the same page because of a team meeting. I've been writing about it on my other site, just about, you know, tumultuous times. how team meetings really help you get on the same page. They typically happen in the beginning of the season after you played a few games, and they're typically, their main purpose is communication. It's breaking that ice of stuff you wanted to say to somebody that you haven't said all year. You know exactly what I'm talking about. You know how as athletes, we hold stuff in, this and that. They had that communication and they played this game like they were a team that was what? Like you said, all freaking thing connected. They were connected again. The Bucks have been reconnected. This is a level of connectivity that I haven't seen them play with since they were on a roll earlier this year.
Yeah, and it was a perfect storm of events because, again, you lose to the Wizards, the worst team. You're playing against a team that's the hottest team in the league, top team in Eastern Conference. So good stuff. Now, here again, this clip, A.J. Green, going to miss that long three-pointer. But watch A.J. Great nice job. Deep. Oh, my God. Just vertical against Tobias Harris. Didn't foul him. Kept his hands up. And then getting out in transition. The Bucks did a masterful job. This is a Piston team.
Yeah, young.
But the Pistons, Chris, they're eighth in fast break points. Whatever. They're fifth in opponent fast break points. But the Bucks ran them out the gym. The Bucks doubled them up on fast break points, 16-8 last night.
But why? Because of the roster makeup. Because now you got guys that can run. You got KPJ and Rollins and AJ Green in the game with Kuz and Bobby. So guess what? We are getting up the floor. There's no more of the Brook thing. There's no more of this Dame pace thing. This is for this game in particular. I saw them matching up against Detroit in the way that I always envisioned this roster at the beginning of the year when the training camp was happening, all the young people. I was like, yes, for these type of games that have always typically have given the Bucks a little bit of trouble in the last couple of years. I was like, this is the type of roster that can fight these guys. And we got enough dogs. You got El Haj, Malik El Shabazz, Ryan Rollins, and then you got KPJ.
Wait, right? You got who?
El Haj, Malik El Shabazz, Ryan Rollins, bro. You ever seen him in the post game with the thing on and the hoodie? Bro, El Haj, Malik El Shabazz, and KPJ. Okay, hey, you got two dogs. Hey, you got two. You need to get up on Ryan Rollins. Look, two dogs that ain't playing with people, okay? They're taking that. And you saw that with the Amen Thompson thing. I was surprised, segue off here. I was surprised that KPJ didn't really go at Asar Thompson after Asar clobbered him across the head. After he took his head off and the head was rolling on the ground, like you said. But here's the thing. It didn't matter him going back at him because he went back at him with his play. You can see KPJ was not tripping on Cade. Asar. He was not tripping. You can see the attitude. You can see it in his aura, MJ. And that rubbed off on everybody else, man.
And that's a next level elite observation. KPJ felt like he was the best player on the floor.
Thank you.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, I just thought about that in the context that you said.
Just
you got
Kate
Cunningham. Kate Cunningham 28-9. You got, you know, Durin averaging 21 and then whatever double doubles. And KPJ has this, it's not even a chip. It's this level of confidence. Like, I'm the best player out here. And I don't know if it's that Seattle, the Rainier Beach kind of swag that they got going on up there, whatever it is. But he's got this swag, man. Like, he's had this whole season.
He's one of the nicest, but he's pound for pound. He's a really nice talent. And I know the NBA people, you can dissect everything and do what you want. But it's for us as hoopers, MJ, when we see a 6'6 lefty doing what he's doing, he's devastating. He is scary. If he could get channeled and corralled like he's been getting, like he can be like a major type of talent in the NBA. This dude is unbelievable sometimes.
I think he's ready to have that jump. That inner epiphany of just like, you know, whatever it is, you know, and he's expressed that since training camp.
Yeah.
Since last year, really, just given another opportunity with a team that believes in me. Doc Rivers anointing him as a starting point guard back in the summer.
I like that.
Ain't no, you got to compete for a position and we're going to see whoever
wins the battle.
Who's the last man is standing after you guys.
The job in camp.
The competition's good. So iron sharpens iron, steel sharpens. No, KPJ is my starting point guard.
Here's the ball.
And we're going to support him and we're going to like uplift him and make him feel comfortable in that role. And that was huge, man. And he played like he thought He was the best player out there. And I want your take on this. I think Ryan Rollins will play better more consistently because now pressure. the burden yes. of carrying this whole thing offensively has shifted. Has shifted. Now he can pick and choose his spots, you know? Yeah. So that's major.
And low key, Rollins don't really want all that offensive burden. No, low key, KPJ be like this to the burden. He'd be like, bring it, come hither, give me the ball, let me break somebody down. I'll do it 100 times a day. Like, it ain't nothing.
Yeah, Ryan's like smoke. Yeah, smoke's getting in my eyes. KPJ's like, I'll take smoke. I want all that second hand. Give me the second hand. I want every bit of smoke you can blow my direction. And to your point, with Star Thompson, who just mangled.
Yeah, you let him be known, though. Hey, you went to bat for him, MJ. Yeah,
come on,
MJ,
man.
MJ, you was funny as hell when you was talking about what is this floor? His head need to be rolling on the floor.
Right. But Tony Brothers, who I love.
That's your boy. That's your guy, man.
Well, you know, on Facebook, he's got this live jazz club in Norfolk where he's from, brother. And I gave him some props last day. I gave him a promo. But just to say that the contact to the face or to the head didn't rise to the level of a flagrant was just absurd to me. But the bigger point was this, is that KPJ got it back. When that spin move, he caught him with that off arm, got an offensive foul because of it. But then KPJ went over and slapped him on the butt like, okay, now we even. You know, it wasn't like, I'm sorry, man. It was like, yeah, see? Now, see how that feel? You know, now we even. You know.
But MJ, I'm asking you a real life question. How could the emphasis, the contact on the above the neck and the head, like how could they miss that play? And did they come back in the 2-minute report? Or has there been anything by the league that has come out and said that should have been called a flagrant or upgraded, or are they letting that go?
Well, I haven't done the research, but I will. And that's a great point because a lot of times, you know, in hindsight, they will look at the video and say that was not the right call. I just don't, I mean.
Yeah, because.
You can see his neck. You can see his neck kind of.
Dog, it was crazy. Like, it was crazy, the blow. I've never seen someone get hit like that and it never not been a flagrant foul.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless it was like the 80s. Unless it's like Kurt Rambis with the ball. Right. You know, no, I'm talking about in the real time, in the future, contemporary American society, that is a freaking flagrant foul like 100 out of 100 times.
And far less than that, I mentioned Jericho Sims against the Wizards or somebody. He bodied somebody up aggressively, kind of going for a box out or something, and they gave him a flagrant, saying he was just too aggressive with the shoulder, he was trying to. And then to see Thompson just slap KPJ upside the head, see his neck wrenched to the side the way it did, and then that called that a flagrant, I thought was
ludicrous.
Egregious. I mean, yeah, so anyway. But look, man, let's hope these Bucks can keep this thing going. I guess Giannis is going to be out for a while with the. The
2-4. 2-4.
You gotta be careful about those, right?
Yeah, man. You gotta be real careful about the calf strain, you know. So it's gonna be imperative for these guys now to kind of step up, dude. This next stretch of games is gonna be super interesting for Milwaukee playing without Giannis, adjusting to this new style with KPJ kind of being this dynamic dude. Doc is officially gonna probably let the reins go. You can see the demeanor. On the sideline yesterday, he's rocking with this situation with KPJ running it. So hopefully the Bucks, you know, we could get some things and get some W's, man.
Are we looking at all zone all the time, or what are we looking at with this zone defense?
It's so funny, man. When I saw
it, looking at Syracuse.
Here's the funny thing. So as I watched the Bucks game, right? You guys came on early, so I watched that game. Then UCLA plays at 8. UCLA had never played one possession of zone all season. Them dudes played an entire game of zone.
Wow.
2-3. So I watched the Bucks defeat the Pistons on the zone. Then I watched UCLA basically barely beat Washington on the zone. So here's my thing with the zone. Play what puts your team in the best position to win. You got to know your personnel between the Bucks and UCLA. You got to know who you got. You got to know who's at the point of attack. And you got to know what time this is. So, Doc, switch it up. Do what you got to do. But do not go away from that zone. That zone done got you a win against the best team in the East.
That's it. All right, man. Listen, we got Monica McNutt coming up in our next segment. And we'll keep an eye on these Bucks, man. Got a tough stretch of games ahead. But so far, so good. With KPJ and Ryan Rollins, the zone and everything that's happening, all the good stuff in the midst of all this noise. He's Chris Johnson. I'm Marcus Johnson. Right back.
All right. Welcome back to Here District. Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson. And we are excited to be joined by one of the bright young personalities in the basketball TV landscape, Monica McNutt. She's an ESPN analyst and color analyst for ESPN New York for the Knicks radio gig. And Monica, thank you so much for joining Here District.
No problem. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, we're excited about this. So what we like to do, Monica, we like to kind of get backstory on our guests and find out kind of some of the events of your life that have led you to this point today, to where you are right now. And listen, and this is the first thing I wanted to start off with. And I got to walk gingerly along this path, because I don't know how it was when you grew up. But my name is Marcus, M-A-R-Q-U-E-S. Uh-huh. So every time I went to a new class, a new teacher, it was always Marquez, Marquise. I became really self-conscious about the way my name was spelled. Like, why couldn't they just spell it M-A-R-Q-U-E-S? You got a name, McNutt. Okay? And I'm just wondering, either your parents did a tremendous job of just instilling some great self-esteem, or you had to weather some storms growing up. A name like McNutt, just what are some of the challenges, if any? Maybe there were none. Maybe it was just naturally accepted as a Johnson or a Robertson or a Davidson. I kind of doubt it. But how was it growing up with that name coming up, man, in the time that you came up?
Marcus, this is crazy. I actually love this question. I don't get asked it a ton, but I still to this day get reactions on my last name. I'm like, bro, grow up. I can remember vividly grade school sort of being teased. Now, I went to a small Christian school through ninth grade, but I think so grade school was probably the height of it, because we were all, at this point, most of us matriculated together, so it was commonplace. Like, and then my mom actually became a teacher, and like, you wasn't going to clown on a teacher. But every time we would go to a different camp in the summer, I remember going to Aqua Day Camp in Northeast DC, like, or we would go to a basketball camp, any reintroduction among young people was like, your last name is what? And it was, oh God. Now, for whatever reason, I remember being really sad about it one time. But other than that, I think you learn to just be like, yes, that's my last name. Now, come on, check up or whatever we about to do. Like, okay, that's my last name, and don't you forget it. So I'm really proud of, you know, my family heritage and having the opportunity to do, what are those things called? Family tree, type of project and stuff. And like tracing back to our roots, like in Kentucky with my great, great grandfather, so on and so forth. I'm proud of it. At this point, I think it's something that sort of adds to my personality, because if you want to crack a joke, fine, but I can crack jokes too. So let's go.
But have you run across others with that same last name that you weren't related to? Or if you see a McNutt someplace, is it pretty much a given that he's going to be part of that family tree?
So two stories on that. There was a young man that played football at Iowa. I think his first name was Marvin. I'm not sure. We are not related. But okay. I remember when I was covering Big East basketball and I had to go to Creighton a couple times. And so in the airport, people would ask me if I was related, because he was having a pretty stellar year at Iowa. And I was like, no. And then one time with the Knicks, a bus driver was like, let me show you something. And he like showed me his ID, and we ended up having this conversation trying to see if we had people in common in terms of cities. Yeah. And it turned out that we did not. I think my sister has had folks reach out to her like via Facebook, but we don't have a particularly large family. So I've heard the name a few other times. I've obviously seen McNult with the L, but I've probably met those two instances. And I think one other time I met some folks with the same last name that were black folks. So yeah, it's out there.
Yeah. So I'm going to, you know, end it with this, but when my son, our name Johnson, before it was changed to the slave master's Johnson, was Longino. It was French, Longino. Chris, that's one of Chris's aliases. It was Longino, right?
L-O-N-G-I-N-E-A-U-X,
whatever. But when my son Josiah was at Crenshaw High School, don't ask me how he wound up at Crenshaw his first 2 years. He was way above his intelligence quotient there. No textbooks and no... Yeah. Anyway, that's another story. But one of his teammates, okay, Longino, was a kid named Mike Longino. who spelt it the same mm-hmm. way but pronounced it differently. And once I found that out, we started doing a deep dive in his background and found out that we were distant cousins. So, you know, it's just interesting how that happens wow. with us, you know. So anyway, that's a story within itself. But listen, so I'm looking at your bio, and I got to ask you this because I don't know if it's a misprint or if there's a story. I love these kinds of stories, but we'll see. So you made all conference at high school at the Academy of the Holy Cross in Maryland. Mm-hmm. You made all conference as a 10th grader. You made all conference as an 11th grader. But on this bio says nothing about your senior year.
Uh-oh.
Which is just weird to me. Did you make all conference as a senior?
Golly, MJ, you're taking it back. Did I? I think I did. I was all met out of the Washington, D.C. area. We won the WCAC championship at that level. Like, I should have been. I'm pretty sure I was. I don't know why that's
okay.
not there.
I mean, it's probably a misprint, but, you know, when you see something like that, I don't know if you got hurt your senior mm-hmm. year, missed a chunk of games, or, you know, there's normally a story like that behind something like that. Like my guy that we played the other night, C.J. McCollum, mm-hmm. was the Patriot League MVP his sophomore and his senior year, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I'm always wondering what happened that junior year. I think he had an injury that limited his amount of games. So anyway, so you were a great player in high school. Two-time captain, three-time all-conference player. Why Georgetown? Why not expand your roots and go
Tennessee.
West or go south? Or why Georgetown?
UConn.
Why stay in
D.C.? UConn. You know.
All right.
UConn.
Okay. Yeah. So the
St. John's.
So there's two truths of this. I was not the caliber of UConn and Tennessee. For one.
Okay. Okay.
And I can be honest about that. I think the biggest recruiting at the time for me was University of Maryland. And y'all, I was very clear that I wanted to go and play. At the time, mm-hmm. Marissa Coleman, who's a WNBA champion, won a championship at University of Maryland, had just gone to Maryland. She was 2 years older than me in high school. And we played in the same high school conference. So I had battled her and played behind her, and I wanted to go and play and have my name be a part of bringing a program to life. The second part, though, why I landed on Georgetown is because I met John Thompson Jr. on my visit. And we had long been fans of Georgetown, coming up, falling in love with the game of basketball, alongside my dad, who had loved it for a long time, who was mm-hmm. at St. Anthony's right before Big John came. Like, my uncle played for Big John at St. Anthony's before he went on to the collegiate ranks. So wow. we had this affinity in our household for Georgetown and for John Thompson. And so meeting him in person was like, oh, wow. Like, yes, I'm not going to go play for the men's program, but the organization still had the lore. And my mom in this process was very much like, look at these Ivy League schools, though. You could go to Princeton. And I was like, well, I'm not going to Princeton. Like, I'm not doing that. And so ultimately, it felt like Georgetown was the place that gave me most of what I wanted. The legacy of the school and what the degree would mean, the opportunity to go and play and truly be a part of bringing a program back to the forefront. At the time, Terry Williams-Fenoy was the head coach, which was one of the few black women, if I remember correctly, this is years ago, one of the few black women head coaches that was recruiting me and that was doing it in the country. And that was a big deal to me in terms of examples. And I remember saying to my parents, you know, I could pretend that Georgetown's in Africa if I want to, but if I want to come home and get some home cooking, I can do that too. So that's how we landed on Georgetown.
My all-time favorite Georgetown player. I'm going to ask you about yours, so I'll give you a moment to think about this. But man, I was so enamored, and Chris remembers this. With that backcourt, it was Michael Jackson and Gene Smith. And these two brothers used to slap the floor and get down low. I mean, it's just, you know, I'm out in Los Angeles. So we had Stevie Thompson went out to Syracuse. Right. Had Kevin Ollie went to UConn. So we had a couple of guys from Crenshaw that head back east. So that kind of put the Big East, you know, on my basketball radar. But when I watched those dudes, from some all-time favorite Georgetown player, I don't know if you can guess. But it's a dude that was like a Joe Hardy in the play Damn Yankees. He was he appeared on the scene and then he kind of just disappeared. You never pretty much heard from him again. But Michael Graham, do you remember Michael Graham mm-hmm. against maybe I don't know if that was before your time, but they won the national championship with Patrick Ewing in Seattle. This lefty ball menacing. That's before ball heads was cool. Lefty. But my point is that you were talking about the tradition of Georgetown. It's just remarkable about how it travels, you know, mm-hmm. all the way on the West Coast. Here I am. I'm an established, you know, elite level basketball player, all-star. And I'm just fascinated with everything John Towns. I got a chance to meet him at Dookie Chase down in New Orleans during the Final Four years and years and years ago. And I asked him, Monica, I said, what's the key to being a good coach? And he told me, like, that draw is, Marcus, you know, coaching is a lot like fishing. If you're in a lake and nothing's biting on this side, you move to the other side. If the worms ain't working, you maybe use a piece of bread. You just try different things till you find something that works. I'll never forget that moment. And I'm like you, George, I can understand John Thompson, the impression that he made on you and why you wound up at Georgetown because of it.
Yeah.
What are the reasons?
Yeah. He's great. I think having the opportunity to sort of glean off of him. Of course, by the time I got to campus, he had retired as a coach, but was still very much present at both the men's and women's practices. Like, when we knocked off Maryland in the NCAA tournament, like, he's in our locker room. I still have the pictures of him celebrating with us. And the last time I saw him before he started to take ill, he knew I was in this space, and he had a long-running sports radio show in D.C., and he's just like, keep at it, girl, you got it. That was kind of the last thing I remember him saying to me. I bumped into him at a I can't remember if we were, it was a Wizards game, it probably was a Georgetown game, but they're all at Capital One Arena. So,
yeah.
But he just, I've read his book, I Came as a Shadow, terrifically written by Jesse Williams, and you could feel his booming voice, his presence, the power of all that he did and all that he represents. I'm actually looking in my office, that I've got a picture from when the Nike World Headquarters here in New York dedicated the court to him. We were all there and asked to be a part of the celebration. He is someone that I could not have forecasted the sort of impact that he had on my life, because he wasn't my coach, right? But I went to his school. So it's been really cool. I mean, you talk about the basketball being a gift that continues to give.
And Monica, I was curious, just during that time pre-Georgetown, who were some of your mentors? Who were some of the basketball players you looked up to? And then some of the people maybe in your life at school, a coach or somebody like that, that really had you locked in? Maybe it's your parents. Talk to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the basketball space, I remember being so consumed with, obsessed with, fascinated by Carmelo Anthony, which is hilarious. That's because now it's like sort of my co-host podcast guy. But I think at Syracuse, my dad and I would go out and we would drill some of the stuff that we saw him doing. And I remember making a poster the year that they all went to the Final Four. It was like, what was it? Syracuse, Marquette, Texas, Tennessee, Kansas. UConn, and Kansas on the men's side. Tennessee and UConn. And I'm blanking on the other two schools on the women's side. But I remember sitting and cutting out the Washington Post clippings all season long. Like, just being so captivated with both men's and women's college basketball. I remember that in my formative years for sure. And then I would say the WNBA. The WNBA launched in 1996. I think we got the Mystics, I want to say, in 98. And the first, like, 5 years of the Mystics run, we held a bunch of records in the city for attendance. Like, we were there. Nikki McCray, God rest her soul, Shamika Holsclaw, like, Muriel Page. Like, we were there. We were at those games. We were cheering this team on. We held these records for attendance. And so I remember being like, Dad, we got to get home. I need to see, like, the sparks in the comments, like Cheryl Swoops, Cynthia Cooper, Tina Thompson. Like, to have Cheryl Swoops now as a colleague in this space is so incredible and so encouraging. So I consumed basketball as a kid, particularly women's basketball and college basketball. I'll admit, my NBA love sort of came later. But it was just such a game that was so beautiful and I wanted to be a part of. And my dad had been a high school referee before I was born. So, like, it was like, Dad, I want to go with you. Like, and I can remember having a conversation with him in about third grade. It's like, Dad, I want to play. And he's like, you want to play or you want to be good? And I was like, no, I want to play and I want to be good. And so that, for me, embarked on my personal journey with the game at that age.
Oh, man. You mentioned the name Shamika Holsclaw. People don't remember how good Shamika Holsclaw really was. When they talk about some of the best, I know for me, when I was in college, like 94 through around the 98 era, Tennessee women's basketball was dominant. And that's kind of why I mentioned them. Actually, my freshman year, we won a national championship and we went to the White House with Geno, his first national championship team.
Uh-huh.
So Rebecca Lobo's there and, you know, that whole crew. So I was kind of there at the beginning of that Geno era. But we were in love with Tennessee basketball because of just all the players from, it was like, to me, I mean, Tamika Catchings and a bunch of players during the era, but Shamequa Hosecall to me always really stood out as somebody that, you know, she was must see TV. We would rush home for practice, try to get to the dorm, catch ESPN. But segueing over to the WNBA, Project B has been something that has sort of sent shockwaves through the women's basketball professionally, came up, had a ton of money associated with, you know, Saudi Arabia, but also some very high level basketball people. I actually had Alana Beard, who's doing a lot of stuff. I had her on my podcast years ago when she was involved with trying to bring a team to San Francisco with an African-American ownership group. I don't know if you remember that. She was involved with that a few years ago, but I talked to her. She's involved with the situation. I wanted to get your vantage point, Monica, on just how do you feel about this? Project B, the they come along to kind of coincide with the WNBA players negotiations. They're throwing big money at people. You know, this is another negotiation over here going on. Nafisa Collier's got unrivaled. I mean, it's a crazy time in women's basketball. I just kind of wanted to get your take on everything. And where do you see this? Do you think there's going to be a resolution with the WNBA Players Association? And do you also think that Project B is something that's going to get off its feet?
Ooh, all right. So
sorry for the long-winded nature.
It's a lot going on, Chris. I think it is a crazy time, but it is an exciting time. I can remember the Final Four in Dallas a few years back when LSU won, and we were doing the prep meetings, and Don Staley basically was like, you know, ESPN is cool, but we need more folks to fight for these rights, of the broadcast rights. She's like, that's when the opportunity will grow for all involved, right? That's when you get the money and the growth. And that's what we're seeing happening on the WNBA side. There are now more options for professional athletes to take their talents, which ultimately raises the bar as these leagues compete, if you will, air quotes, compete for the best talent. And then, of course, the demand from fans and the interest and the investment. I mean, this has been a year-over-year increase, right? And so I'll be honest, I have not delved deeply into Project B. But I think when you see the names that Project B is attracting, I mean, Nneka Ogumike is at the top of that list, right? You know it's no joke. And when you consider the stalemate, if you will, but of the collective bargaining agreement right now for the WNBA, like, it makes sense for these athletes to take, at least explore the other opportunities. For years, the only exploration has been to go overseas. And don't get me wrong, a ton of WNBA players have made excellent lives playing basketball overseas. Whether they should or should not have to is a debate. Whatever you stand on that, that's fine. But I think the idea that elite athletes have other opportunities is healthy in terms of how you do business at any level. We just happen to be talking about women's sports players, right? The NBA sort of has this lore because it represents the greatest in the world, both in terms of talent and treatment, right? If the WNBA is not going to be the greatest in the world in talent and treatment, then the best athletes have every right to explore what they believe is the best fit for their talent. So I think it's a really interesting time. Part of me sits back and says, the issue, not the sole issue, but one of the issues in this is we are still working as a society at large on allowing women to compete as athletes, both in the sport and at the collective bargaining agreement in the boardroom at these tables. Work stoppages have happened in every sport. Like,
facts.
You know what I mean? Like, yes, uncomfortable, but that is the nature of what the task is at hand. And so for me, while I would not want to see a lockout, I do think that this collective bargaining right agreement for the WNBA is so important, not just to the WNBA, but to all of the women's leagues and the athletes that I've talked to, whether you talk about the PWHL, the newly launched softball league, the AU Love Volleyball Leagues, like all of these leagues sort of take their cues from what the WNBA is able to do. And so, yes, this collective bargaining agreement affects WNBA athletes primarily, but it also sets the table for how these other leagues that support women's sports and support women's athletes are going to be able to move.
And while we're talking about the WNBA, Monica, your take on this Caitlin Clark savior kind of narrative that's still kind of put out there. But I thought you had a pretty interesting take on that. Can you share some of that with us about Caitlin Clark and her, you know, what she means to the WNBA? We're not discounting her impact, but let me hear you hear your thoughts on that.
Child, Marcus, you oh Lord.
Hey, he gonna get you in trouble. He my gonna get social, you in trouble.
My no. social's about to start popping again. Oh Lord.
He gonna get you in trouble, Monica.
No, listen. I'm with you, Marcus. I never take anything away from Caitlin Clark. She's a dynamic athlete. I think what we have asked, right, folks to listen to and acknowledge is that the framework, the groundwork, whichever terminology you want to use, was laid for her to take this thing to the next level. But the league is not made up of solely one person. And right. frankly, whether people want to deal with it or not, the reality is that some of the intention that came with her was disingenuous in terms of pushing personal agendas that, to Caitlin's credit, she has said that she does not necessarily align with, right? So to her credit, and not that every athlete is going to be an activist. You can't put that on folks. Frankly, when I think about myself at 22, 23, I don't know if I should have been in front of a microphone either, right? And so I'm not asking her necessarily to be an activist. That's not it at all. But I do think sure. folks that have consumed the WNBA and seen the rise and attributed to her popularity, great, love that. But there is a very clear distinction of folks that were here because they love the game of basketball and folks that jumped in and wanted to weaponize the package that she comes in against the rest of, well, not, I shouldn't say the rest of the league, but they wanted to weaponize it to further their agendas, which did not pay respect to a large part of the league.
Rex.
Yeah, and one of those athletes that you talked about, Angel Reese, she's a big part of the DMV. That's the District, Maryland, and Virginia.
What's so let me get you right, Marcus. Hold up.
Okay. Hold up. Get me right. Get,
Angel is a Baltimore girl.
So that's Ooh. Not the DMV.
Correct.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Baltimore.
See, I never knew
respect,
that.
Respect, love Baltimore. But Baltimore is not the DMV. Baltimore is an entity unto itself. So she's a Baltimore girl. But she's a Maryland girl. We can go with Maryland, yes.
That's
okay.
Huge.
Okay. So and so you just dropped some knowledge on me that I did not know. But talk about the DMV. And so I am very well aware of some of the all-time greats from, you know, Elgin Baylor and Dave Bing from before my era. Then you can, you know, Kermit Washington, who's a really good friend of mine, American University. You know, he's the terrific player. Co-worker Milt Newton, our assistant general manager. He claims to have dunked on Michael Graham in a summer league that Michael Graham was going to beat. Michael Graham got really pissed off about when we had a little Facebook deal. But what is this about the DMV? There's an energy there. See, in L.A., and Chris, you can attest to this or not, but there's a certain style. I mean, fundamentally sound, not a whole lot of flair and flash. Paul Pierce, Kawhi Leonard, Baron Davis, kind of out of the box, but really fundamentally sound. I think a lot of that is UCLA. You can point to John Wooden, UCLA in the 60s, not a whole lot of emotion and antics and all that. New York is the opposite of it. You know, it's a lot of flash and a lot of antics and a whole lot of trash talking. The DMV, specifically, Kevin Durant and some of these greats, Stevie Francis, one of my favorites, Jeffrey, I mean, guys like that. What is it about the DMV? If you could stamp a personality trait on ballers from that area, what would it be?
Man, I should have brought my dad with me on this pod, Marcus. Y'all could have rapped for, like, yeah. Y'all would have just
Did
had
he play
a whole
ball? Was your dad a ball player?
He played, he walked on at George Mason, but he's a career referee, and now he's coaching high school basketball in the D.C. area. So all of those guys, I know all of these guys that you just rattled off because of my dad, right?
Right.
Let's see, if I had to boil down a hooper out of the DMV, their skill set.
Just the energy, what kind of attitude the DMV ball players have that maybe separates them from other regions of the country?
I think there is a smooth grit, if I can put those two words together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we have our guys that were always chirping and you were like, where are you from? Yeah, sure. Right. but I think to me, when I think of guys, even my colleagues up at Georgetown, like, were guys that opted to stay local. And even like a Josh Hart, who's now on the Knicks with the Knicks, and he came through the DMV as well. I think there is there's a toughness. But there is sort of this well-rounded skill set. Like a New York guard, you know, usually the handles are crazy. They get into the paint. Shooting might be questionable. I think when you look at guys out of the D.C. area, they usually can shoot. Like they go get to the mid-range. They might not be the craziest off the bounce, but like they're gonna make the smart plays and the grittier plays in the game, right? KD obviously is one of one to come out of the area, but then I think about like when I was coming through high school, it was like KD, Michael Beasley, like Austin Freeman, Chris Wright. We all went to Georgetown together. Like these were guys that had really incredibly well-rounded games, and then they could kind of just pick their spots based on matchups, if you will. So I think that there was like sort of a smooth grit about our games coming out of the D.C. area.
They had this crossover, Monica. The D.C. You know the D.C., John. But they were hitting everybody with it like all the time, the whole tournament. Everybody just coming down. Bow.
Yeah. And it was new. It was new. We hadn't seen it before. And it was new. And they would just
Yank.
And that's one that's come down through the ages, right?
That's always fun for me. So let's talk about, and we're not going to keep you much longer, Monica. I appreciate you so much for your time. But so now, you know, you got your pulse on the finger, on the whatever of the NBA, working for the Knicks and seeing it pretty much all. We got a backcourt in Milwaukee that I think has a chance to really be special. Young backcourt, Kevin Porter Jr. and Ryan Rollins. You know, we've been struggling as of late. What is it going to take for the Milwaukee Bucks to get back on the right track? Should they lean into more three-point shooting, even though they're tops in the league in terms of a percentage? If just your analytical cap in terms of this Bucks team, is it so Giannis centric that we beat the Pistons without Giannis last night? That was more of an anomaly than anything else. But I mean, because we play great, but just watching from the outside, when you think about this Milwaukee Bucks team, is what I'm trying to get this perspective from you. And you've seen a lot of teams. Where do you think this team is lacking? What do they need to do a better job of? What should they lean in more to?
Well, I'm going to start with this. I think Ryan Rollins is a great story. I think he's still a little bit under the radar, probably nationally for sure. But now that we're 20 games in, you start to see everybody like, people are now hip to this. Oh, no, this isn't a rookie that just got off to a great start. Like, he's solid. Now, a little bit of a sprinkle of a redemption story in there. Shout out to him for making the most of his next opportunity. We all have some things in our past that we were not necessarily proud of. I think that young man, as a two-way guy, potentially, like, there's not many players who I watch and I'm like, ooh, they really are, like, kind of giving JB some fits defensively. And in that first game, for sure. Now, part of that, I will couch that and say Jalen Brunson gets off to a slow start. He's turned a corner as of late. The last time here, when the Bucks came to New York, that was a little bit less of the story. But that young man, I still think, is someone that is very impressive, and I'm excited to see what the future holds for him. In isolation, Marcus, when I look at the Bucks roster, what I've seen, they seem to have the ingredients of this new age NBA. Everybody wants to play faster. You want a big that can shoot. That's Miles Turner. The Giannis Antetokounmpo of it all. He is still undeniably one of the greatest that our game has to offer, but the way he plays and the supporting cast around him maybe doesn't mesh as well as it has in the past. And I think that's okay. Like, Doc Rivers is a guy that's won a championship in this league. Like, he knows how to coach and he knows how to figure it out. A guy that, from our earlier conversations, I'm sure has sat at the foot of a Big John, right, and had the opportunity to learn about trying different things. I look at the shooting that you guys have. Green, what's my guy? Gary Trent Jr. Like, that's the nature of the league. I don't know the answer, though, for the Bucks as I look at it. Because I just think so much of, and even for me, sitting in New York the last 4 years with the Knicks, so much of those first two seasons was just that the Knicks played hard. Like, literally, they just played hard. And that was their calling hard. Teams are like, you're going to have to play hard against them. They're going to fight and scrap for everything. And I wonder if that is probably the way that this Bucks team needs to go a little bit. Not that they haven't. But then I look at the Eastern Conference and really, like, there's sort of your four teams that represent the upper echelon-ish. And, like, Cleveland is sort of ishy right now. So I think anytime you have Giannis Antetokounmpo, you have opportunity for sure. Yeah. And anytime you've got, which I got like three guys shooting close to 40% from the three-point line.
Yeah, like, yeah. But as a team, like I think 41% right now in the all-time NBA high three-point shooting.
So, yeah. Like, there are pieces there. I think, as we all know, consumer basketball matchups make fights, right? Styles make fights, rather. And so that's probably what I find to be the most curious. Because when things slow down, like, what is the trust level? Whether Giannis is, one, available, and two, if Giannis is 100, like, what percentage of Giannis are you getting as he's had to navigate injuries the last few years?
Yeah, and that's facts. And then I did the, well, so we're going to end it on this. I read an interesting tidbit in your biography about a core sisterhood of African-American ladies that helped you kind of get established and get a foothold in this business. Can you just give us that story and then we'll let you get out of here?
Man, Marcus, I'm so fortunate. I think that story is continuing to write itself. Coming out of Georgetown, LaChyna Robinson was covering women's college basketball for a number of networks. I'm now so fortunate to call her not just a mentor, but a friend. Mm. And she was one that really was like, hey, pull up a chair, roll with me, and helped me navigate the space. But that has expanded to so many great women in this space. I mean, Elle Duncan, Christine Williamson, Andrea Carter, like just Chelsea Sherrod here in New York. Like there's so many women in this space. Kayla Gray up in Toronto. Even Melanie, what's Melanie's last name?
Melanie Ricks
in Milwaukee. I think what I am so pleased about in this space right now is this, my generation has moved a little bit from the generations prior to us. And I will even say for myself, when I first got in this business, you would look at a local station trying to find a job and you'd literally say to yourself like, oh, they got a black person, or oh, they got a woman already. There's no room for me, right? And so this generation of women in this space has been so supportive. And I think we can candidly say to one another, hey, I'm also interested in this job, but like, good luck to you. Or this doesn't work for me. Like, I lobbed your name up for some stuff that I had to turn down. Like, or girl, let's just talk about navigating this space, and it has nothing to do with the job at all. And so I'm really, really fortunate. It is a unique experience. I have so enjoyed what I get to call work and make a living off of. Certainly, as you guys know, it comes with its sacrifices, but it's been really cool to be able to do this and lock arms with women who are sharing your experience and your aspirations.
What is the one recurring thing that your mentors have told you to either be aware of or to do more of, do less of? Is there one thing in particular that kind of keeps coming up whenever you're getting suggestions, advice, direction from these ladies?
I think it's always like, try it. Why not? You know, I earlier in my career, the very practical advice was like, slow down. You're talking too fast.
Yeah.
And now
I got that. I got a lot of that.
Right.
Yeah.
And now I think we are all, I guess it would be two things. It would be try it. Why not? If you've got an idea or you want to do something, put it out there and see what happens. Like, don't let fear guide you. Right. And the second thing would be, it's sort of a popular saying now, is like, you are who you think you are. Like, just encouraging one another. Yeah. Because the industry at times will have you believe that you don't belong for whatever reason, right? Like, the topic is hot, you're not perfect, you make a mistake, people disagree with your opinion, like, whatever. I've been on the high side of social, the low side of social, in between. Like, these ebbs and flows can feel like it is everything. And you really just got to survive it. Like, it's not everything. While social media is a very powerful tool for the way that we engage and consume sport, like, that's not necessarily reality. And so I think we do a really good job of keeping one another grounded and just making sure that, like, hey, everything that you've gotten, you've worked for. And I don't care what nobody says. Like, I watched you do it, you know?
Yep. Well, listen, I watched you a lot and watched your, I won't even say growth. You hit the ground running. You were good when you first started. You're good now. And just keep up the great work, and just so proud of you in terms of, you know, how you handle your business, you know, and to be able to do it without playing in the WNBA and being a name that everybody recognizes, and to get in there and carve out a niche for yourself is really impressive. And just want to give you your prop for that.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Chris. I really appreciate that.
No, we appreciate you, Monica.